Yeah, so the things that are.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to day three of Legislative Days and to the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. We'd like to welcome the millions listening in 198 countries live around the globe today to this exciting hearing. Thanks for being here early on a Wednesday. And we're going to open an informational meeting and call up Paul Mather for an update on the transportation projects and implementation of 2015 legislation. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Rather than doing my normal tour of projects around the state, since we're in the spring and not a lot has been going on since we met last about projects, I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about a couple of bills that passed in 15, actually in 16, and just give you an update on our implementation of those bills and where we are. The two specifically I wanted to talk about was the speed limit bill and then the cable barriers that we also talked about back in 2015. So in 2015 and again and in 16, we raised speed limits on highways in eastern Oregon. The new speeds became effective March 1, and we were successful in making that change within 3 days of March 1 on the entire system. So here again is the map that you've seen as we've talked about this, I-80 4 east of the Dalles, and then a number of secondary highways in eastern Oregon, measuring about 1,200 miles in total of highways. The issues that we talked about were just from a cost standpoint. Again, part of why I'm here is just to give you an update on our fiscal, what our estimate was. There were some questions about that when we were talking about the bill, and I committed to come back and just talk to you about what our final costs were. The costs that we talked about were the speed limit signs themselves and then the curve warning signs that needed to be adjusted as we went through the system. The piece that I didn't recognize or didn't fold into our fiscal was the striping piece. And I'm going to talk mostly about that today, where you have pass, no pass striping and the adjustments that we had to make on those secondary highways. Obviously, it's not an issue on the interstate. And I think that's what was mostly in my mind when we were talking about this from a signs and curves and so forth. But that pass, no pass became quite an issue for us that I want to talk about. So back to the signs, we had to add limits to the sign. We had to add on those secondary highways, that second sign was added for trucks because now we had different speeds for cars and trucks on those secondary highways. We went from a basic rule to a limit, so I had to add that. And then we needed a larger post to add all that. So additional signs, additional words. You had different posts. I actually brought one of the signs in. I'm sure you've noticed coming in one of the signs, just to give you an appreciation about how big those signs really are. There's a 27-foot post that goes on that sign. By the time it goes into the ground, 7 feet, and then sticks up so you can see it. That sign there is about 9 feet long, the post that's on that, so it's got the rest of the post cut off of it just so we get it in the building. But just to give you some appreciation for what our folks do installing the signs. The real issue and the challenge became the striping. So we had until March 1st to implement, but really when we talk about striping, we had about 10 weeks from when the governor signed it to when we started to get winter weather in October and we couldn't stripe anymore. And in those 10 weeks, we had to look at the 1,200 miles and see where we had to make the adjustments. So when you're at 55 miles an hour, your sight distance required for pass is about 900 feet, but as those speeds go up, the distance needs to increase and thus the adjustments to the pass, no pass striping that we had. We also needed to come up with an engineering document that was signed by an engineer as we have crashes on the system and we get legal challenges for the condition of the highway. We need to have documentation that showed that the pass, no pass was correct for the conditions. The issue became, how do we do that? Our normal way of doing that is two guys in a stick and a wheel going out on the highway and basically saying, can you see me now? And thinking about doing that over 1,200 miles within 10 weeks, setting a set of plans, giving that to our striping crew so they could actually go out and implement that on 1,200 miles became a daunting task. So what I got today is just a short video just to show you in more clear terms than I can explain to you just how we actually pulled that off in that 10 weeks.
House Bill 3402. The legislature passed this in July last year. What it did was to raise fees on 1,200 miles of rural highway and 300 miles of interstate in eastern Oregon. It took most of that 1,200 miles of rural highway and took it from 55 miles an hour to 65 miles an hour. Cars, 60 miles an hour. So the interstate from the Dow, Ontario, goes from 65 to 70 for passenger vehicles and 60 miles an hour for truck. There were a lot of implications. You raise the speed limit, what else is affected? Find transition areas where you might be coming to a new speed limit in a city and strike in particular, pass or no pass. Those are safe. You have to do higher speed all across the system. And the traditional way of doing that was for somebody to go stand in the middle of the road another person go down the distance that particular speed said you should be that far away if you're going to start a passing maneuver. And they would talk back and forth and say, well, can you see me now? And we thought that for 1,200 miles of rural two-lane highways, that was a daunting task. Couldn't there be another way, a safer way, and a more efficient way if you're trying to evaluate where we needed to be? And we spent a little bit of time trying to figure out if any other state had gone through this in such a large change on a two-lane rural highway. And what we got back was that most of the upper speed limits that had happened were on larger facilities like interstate. And this kind of striping issue hadn't had to be considered over the course of hundreds of miles of highway. So we thought about a lot of things, and one of the things that came up was that the Department of Transportation had a vehicle that allowed us to collect information about our highway in a pretty amazing way.
Our mobile mapper is mounted on top of a vehicle, and it contains 7 cameras that take a panoramic image. It also has a laser scanner that collects about 1 million points per second, and the images are collected at about every 25 feet.
We determined that the data set that we have, which is essentially LIDAR that we collected across all the state highway systems with our mobile mapping device, was something we could use to determine the site distance requirements for the no passing zones. LIDAR is light detection and ranging, and it is a tool that is used to calculate or to capture 3D positions of anything you want. And so it is essentially a system that puts out a laser pulse that goes off in a particular direction, hits something like a tree, comes back, and we can calculate the distance. Then based on calculating the angles and distance, we can get a 3D point in space, and then we do that millions of times a second, and we end up with what you might think of as a hologram, one way to think of it, or as a 3D photograph. A photograph that you can actually step into, look around, up, down, left, right, measure, and do whatever you want. It's very accurate, within a quarter of an inch or so. We sat down and discussed whether it was possible. We discussed who would do what, and we came up with this collaborative effort. Geomatronics, taking the existing data that we had and mining it for the information that was needed so that the roadway team could then calculate the site distances, who would then pass it on to the traffic team, who would develop a set of plans so that they would then pass that on to the striping crew who would stripe the roads.
After Geomatronics gets the data, we take it and process it, and then we trace the features of the roadway and create a map, and then that is used to create a model of the roadway.
What roadway's part was, after we collected the data from the Geomatronics unit, we created a three-dimensional model of the roadway, representative of the roadway location, and then included a vertical element at the edge of the pavement that then we used our design software package to analyze the site distances, where the site distance was acceptable or not acceptable, and then gave that off to traffic.
It required a lot of collaboration across many different disciplines, across a lot of different offices and geographic locations. We had regions and districts across regions 4 and 5 and the respective striping crews and traffic crews out there as well. Everybody had their own little piece of the pie, and every piece was extremely critical. But the end goal was to get a plan to the striping crew as quickly as possible in a way that they could easily pick up and lay out and install before the end of the season.
So out of all of that, we were able to get all of the striping in place well in advance of the close of the weather season, and signs will all be going up within the first week of when the new speed limits are operational, which is the week of March 1st.
LiDAR is an amazing technology. It enables the creation of a virtual world which can be used for a multitude of things, and your imagination is really the only limiting factor. We can use it to extract all sorts of data and information from it. We can use it to overlay things on it, and in essence, we're creating the world at your fingertips. This effort actually showed the value of collecting LiDAR data across the entire state highway system, and without it, we would have struggled to accomplish this task.
So this is the same technology we use in our construction processes now, with our designers doing the work and handing that off to contractors who load that information data right into their equipment, are able to build roadways essentially without the traditional survey that that we do. So it's pretty amazing technology. We just found a unique way to apply that technology to help us in this situation. If we hadn't found this, I'd probably be sitting up here today telling you we're still in implementation of the speed zone. We had to wait till the weather cleared. We were still out there doing the old-fashioned way of identifying those speed zones. So it was a great innovation and efficiency for us. So the cost. So original estimate was $748,000. Our actual cost for the signs and the speed signs and the curve signs was just slightly less than that. But when you add the striping in, we still have some final costs coming in. We're going to be in the neighborhood of about $1.5 million. I can tell you that cost would have been significantly more if we were still out there doing the implementation of the striping. And it saved us at least 2 or 3 times the amount of money you see there for striping on those costs. So moving on to cable barriers, also in the 2015 session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 921. The bill gave direction to ODOT to close the median with cable barriers on the interstate system where the median was 100 feet or less. Legislature also passed $2.5 million to help fund work in Southern Oregon I-5. We took that $2.5 million and combined it with funding we already had in our program and had enough funds to complete I-5. Our commission in October of 15, from savings and other projects, redirected $5 million and completed or provided enough funding to complete I-205 and I-84 through Multnomah County. With the FAST Act, which you're going to hear about next, there was additional funding that the commission allocated to the balance of I-84. And so I'm here to report today that we have enough funding allocated to complete the entire system, and I would anticipate we'd do that well in advance of that 2021 date that was in the legislation in Senate Bill 921.
But Paul, just to confirm, you said that I-5 has been completed?
It will be.
It will be.
Mr. Chair, yes, there's more work to be done this summer.
Okay.
I guess as I reported on those, that was the funding allocations. We still have the work to do, and that work will be completed over the next 2 or 3 or 4 years as we combine those with other projects and so forth. And some of the funding isn't available till some of the later years, but the good news is we have funding allocations to complete within that 2021 time frame.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I'd like to understand a little bit better. So what can the cable, appreciate what the intent is, but it's not like having a concrete block out there. So what can the cable system stop or not stop? As I've driven back and forth on the freeway, I've seen a few places where it's been hit. I've not watched people hit it. But I'm trying to understand, so what will it stop or not stop?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, it is a barrier system. We have several different types, as I'm sure as you drive on the roadway see. We have concrete barrier, we have traditional guardrail, and then we have cable barrier. Each of the one of those we use in different situations, largely dictated by how much room is behind the barrier. So if there's really no room behind there, then we'll go with the concrete barrier to redirect the traffic back into where they came from, which can be, you know, somewhat problematic. The traditional guardrail has some give to it, but also some redirection to it, where the cable barrier has a lot of give to it, and it's really kind of think of it as a net to kind of catch the vehicle before it goes on, but there's enough room behind it for that system to operate that way. The current design systems we have are for the majority of the vehicles, but several oversized or large trucks, for example, the system may or may not be able to, depends on the particular conditions, the angles, the speeds, and those type of things for some of the larger vehicles. But for traditional vehicles on the roadway, the current systems we're putting in will perform for those, for the vehicles, and keep them from going into oncoming traffic. That's really what we're trying to do with that system, is to prevent those just you know, deadly head-on crashes on the interstate.
I realize we passed the speed limit discussion without an opportunity for questions. Any questions? Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concerns that people have about accidents arising from the higher speed limits are serious. And it's something I've heard a little about in my part of the state, but I've heard I've lost track of the number of people who have thanked us for changing the speed limit to a higher limit on the areas, that the vast areas we have to cross over there. The question is, there are going to be spaces that are not in cities where we need to do something different. And people have come and said, for example, the space between Ontario and Vail has a lot of folks. It's not a city, obviously. And it had been my suggestion to them that we would bring a bill next year to address those specific reaches, that we shouldn't have the faster speed on. We've had people come back and say, let's reduce it. And so that has been my plan to this point. Is there a reason we should move with more alacrity, or do you have the tools available to try to address some of the challenges that we're seeing, for example, on Highway 97?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, that's you described very well an issue that we're struggling with. Obviously, there was clear direction from the legislature to raise speeds on those routes. Clearly, with inside city limits, we have the authority and have reduced those speeds. Where it's difficult is in those transition areas or kind of suburban areas to many of those communities, whether you're in Klamath Falls or you're Ontario or Bend, Redmond. Where you have higher volumes, a lot of driveways, a lot of access points, what we call a lot of roadside culture in those areas, have been difficult for us to kind of find the right place. And so based on the statute that is now in place, are really in a place where we are driven by the data that's out there. So what are the speeds? What is the culture of the roadway? What is the accident history? And that drives our decision making or our ability to lower those speeds. In areas that you describe, and 97 is where we're seeing a lot of those issues as you go around some of those larger communities. We will continue to do analysis in those areas and within our ability of the statutes, lower those speed limits or adjust those speed limits to the appropriate speeds.
Follow up. Thank you. So this reminds me of the discussion we had yesterday in committee concerning the clean air issues, the air toxics issues in Portland, and that there's a community frustration about something not happening right away, and a desire to circumvent, if you will, all of the studies and all of the careful approach that you're doing, all as you should within the law. Do we have other tools available here where to immediately remove this suggestion that this higher speed is damaging people? Do we have the tools? For example, we go to the governor, we ask her for an order, and then instantly we make that change. This means that the government has instantly responded, and I'm asking if we have that tool. If we do, then I know it costs money to change these signs up, but so what? If it means that the people in the area are happy, and we've removed that as a rationale or a fear that these speed limits are causing death and other horrible situations, then so be it. Because there's no reason for us to delay if we have the tools to allow us not to delay. I understand, and it may well be that your studies, as I see from some of the materials you've given me, indicate that it wasn't the higher speed, or studies indicate it wouldn't do any good to reduce the speed. So what? If we can change it right now and remove that as an element of community concern, why wouldn't we? That's kind of my suggestion. But the real issue is there a tool that we can use to, ignoring the cost for a moment, just right, change this right back? Because I think these areas are pretty short. The original intent of my bill and Representative Bredow's bill was to take these long stretches of road, which you can see up there from Burns over to Bend. Well, there isn't anybody out there. It wasn't designed for Terrebonne.
Representative Benz, we're looking at those very things. So what tools do we have? How do you apply those tools is a challenge. So inside city limits, outside, that's pretty clear. Many of these situations that I think we're both thinking of, it's not as clear-cut where they are and where they aren't. And if you start applying this tool that we're coming up to, where do you apply it, where don't you apply it? Where is that line between the roadside culture is just sagebrush and no driveways versus a few driveways, where it's as many driveways? Where do you draw that line to apply some tool to do those transitions outside of our traditional transitions inside and outside cities? As we go to higher speeds on these secondary routes, there's a lot of complicating issues. Raising the speed limits on the interstate is relatively straightforward. Raising speed limits on secondary roads, in particular roadways such as 97 that has a lot of things going on around it in communities and driveways and so forth, becomes very, very complex. Just as I illustrated with the pass, no pass, that's just one issue that we're presented with in trying to implement higher speeds on roadways that have many different factors going on. But I can assure you, we are looking for those tools. The question we're asking ourselves, once we find those tools to the ability we can use them, where do we apply them, and in what circumstances, is the other question we're already asking ourselves.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Representative McLean.
So that was, intriguing and new news to me, so I'm not hearing all those things. So out of the 1,200 miles, what are we talking about? 400, 500 miles of areas that you're studying on those issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, it would be far less than that. I think we were, in our conversations, we're thinking of, a half a dozen to a dozen transition zones outside. I mean, I think you can think about those larger communities within those 1,200 miles. So we're thinking of Ontario, Klamath Falls, Bend, Redmond, Madras, those type of communities. As you go through Lapine towards Bend, we have a four-lane section that makes sense to be at 65. But as you go through a community such as Lapine and further south, what about that transition area that's in there? Or Klamath Falls, just north or just south, you have a lot of development, rural development around that community, which causes a lot of driveways and additional traffic. Traditionally we have a speed transition that may be a quarter mile or half a mile, but maybe we're talking about a transition that's more like 10 miles either side of Klamath Falls that has a lower speed limit, where we have that kind of roadside culture that I just described.
So follow up. Yes. So my idea was that you just showed us this beautiful technology on how you striped those roads and what those folks were capable of, or at least what they said they were capable of, as far as using that technology on site, on those site decisions. And it would seem like if they did that quickly for the striping, that might be also another technique for you to use to really get your data quickly to respond to
We can get the roadside data. It's the crash data, the volume data, the other things within the statute that allows us to make those changes. Mm-hmm. And those are the tools, I think, as I was talking to Representative Benz, are responding to his question, that we're looking for to be able to utilize, that we've got the proper, justification within the statute to make those loads. It's typically not around the roadside data. It's more around the the traffic data. What's the traffic doing from a crash standpoint, from a volume standpoint, and others?
Okay, thank you.
So I have, and I appreciate Representative the concern you raise. What I've learned in this process is everything's connected to something else. And Paul knows in my community, there's been an ongoing discussion about speeds on Main Street, which is a state highway. Now, it's not 65 miles an hour, but I can tell you there's people in the community believe tomorrow if we change that speed, we would solve the problems. And so what concerns me sometimes when we start about a process that we could speed it up, there would be pressure in my community to speed it up and do it. Wouldn't solve the problem. We'd still have the problems out there on Main Street. So from my standpoint, I appreciate the process that you, I understand the frustration with the time it takes to do that. But I can tell you, once we try to respond, and maybe we should, quicker in one situation, there's going to be others then putting the pressure, well, you did it here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then why shouldn't we change the speed limit there? Because there were some accidents, none caused by speed, but there were. And so it's a great conversation. I appreciate the efforts ODOT does to try to respond quickly, but it gets very complex, especially in the eyes of the public, who expect outcomes very quickly and don't necessarily understand what those outcomes might be.
Representative Benz?
Thank you. Is there a coordinated effort between ODOT and the state police to focus a higher level of enforcement on those areas we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we are regular contact with state police to coordinate our safety efforts with them, both at the statewide level and at the local level. Resources is typically an issue for state police and being able to do the enforcement in areas. But we help prioritize where they do put their resources in those areas. And typically, they're out there with our crews and they see the same things we do. Around where the more serious situations are, and focus their enforcement they do have in those areas.
Follow up. So is it, for those who have corresponded with me regarding this issue, am I correct in responding and saying the state police are raising the level of enforcement activity in these areas? Can I say that? Or is this merely that you've pointed out to them they need to do something, or you're encouraging them to do it, and maybe they have, maybe they haven't?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think state police probably should respond to exactly how they prioritize their resources. I know we're in constant communication, and we give them our feedback, but how they prioritize between their enforcement and other activities that they're involved with besides enforcement, I think would be best responded to by them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Paul, I have a question. What is the process? So we passed a statute that said on these portions of highway it would be 65 and 70. So does it require right now an act of the legislature on these sections to reduce the speed, or do you have another statutory process or in rule to be able to reduce speeds?
So, Mr. Chair, it's kind of the line of questioning I was talking with Representative Bounce. We have some ability to make changes to whatever speed, whether it's these 65 or other routes. We have to document that decision. What did we base that decision on lowering it? Because there's clear legislative intent that we should be at 65, and so we need to have a clear reason why we're in this particular situation. So if you're inside of city limits, that's pretty easy to justify why you're going less. It's in these kind of transition rural areas where it's a little less, especially if you don't have the justification from a crash history standpoint or other things that crash history and just how drivers are driving it are the two things that we base our decision on. So if they're out there driving at 65 today and there's not a lot of crash history, even though we think, boy, this looks like something we should lower, it's hard for us to build a case where it should be lower, whether it's Ontario Vale, where people are driving it now at 65. We don't have a history yet built up to justify it based on a crash history standpoint or other justifications within the statute.
And this is a different specific area, but related to speeds. I had come across an article in which ODOT may be raising speeds on some corners because of advancements in vehicle technology. Can you talk about that?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's the advisory speed, so we're not raising the speed limits, but the advisory speeds that we post on curves. Just with newer technology, we can be much more consistent and much more precise around what those numbers are. When I first started with the department, I was a traffic engineer, and we had what was called a ball bank indicator, which was basically a little bubble level you sat on your dash, and you would drive the corner over and over again while you were trying to watch that bubble to see whether it went over the line or not. And that's how we set the corners. And now we have, with the technology I just showed you, a much more precise way and a more consistent way for drivers to anticipate exactly what they should be taking that corner at.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Good.
Okay, now continuing with the Department of Transportation, Trevor Sleeman with a briefing on the Federal FAST Act.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll get the technology sorted here. My name is Trevor Sleeman. I'm the Federal Affairs Advisor and Tribal Liaison at ODOT. And I wanted to give you just a brief overview today of the FAST Act. And then I'll turn it back over to Mr. Mather to talk a little bit more about where we are in terms of implementation. But I'll give you just kind of a general idea of the contents of the bill. So if we rewind a little bit to December, of last year, Congress passed the FAST Act, and this is the multi-year federal authorization of surface transportation policy and spending. So you may be familiar with older acronyms like Safety Lou and MAP 21. This is just the latest iteration of those authorizations. But what's unique about this one is that it's a five-year bill, and it's the first what's considered to be first long-term authorization in over a decade. So for a 10-year period there, we were bouncing around between these really short-term authorizations of the Highway Trust Fund and a policy, sometimes for as short as a few days. And in fact, it's kind of remarkable to consider that the FAST Act has authorized all these programs and spending levels through 2020, 5 years out in advance, when a year ago we didn't know how much federal money we were going to have 5 days from that point. So it's really been an important change and brought some stability back into the system, which is hugely important. So, of course, one of the things folks are most interested in is the funding and what it any changes it brings. And so kind of the general theme when it comes to funding is there are increases, but they're very modest when taken in context. So certainly the orange bars there look pretty nice compared to the flat funding of the few years before that. That's about a 5% increase in 2016 and then about 2% each year thereafter. But you step back a little bit and compare to historical levels there, and you see we don't actually get back to our 2011 federal funding levels until somewhere in that 17-18 period. And if you step even farther back, historically, as we transitioned from one authorization to the next, it wasn't uncommon to see federal funding grow by 40% from one bill to the next. So, 5% here, 2% there isn't really going to upend anything in terms of what we had anticipated from the federal partnership. The other thing I would note too is that the Federal Highway Trust Fund obviously is struggling from a basic financial problem and has been for the last 10 years or so, where there are much higher expenditures coming out of the fund than there are revenues coming into the fund from the federal fuels taxes. They just are not able to bring in sufficient revenues to keep up with expenditures. So over the last 10 years, Congress has had to transfer in on a number of occasions general fund revenues to keep the Highway Trust Fund solvent, and that problem still exists. They in passing the bill, Congress went to some pretty extraordinary measures, some very creative accounting that's, I think, really only possible if you're the federal government. to kind of backfill the trust fund with all sorts of, you know, borrowing from fees and rating accounts at the Federal Reserve Bank to backfill the trust fund. But when we get to the end of this five-year bill, that problem's still going to be there. There's no new sustainable revenue source to shore things up. So, and in fact, I think by punting an additional 5 years out in the future, that problem will only have exacerbated as cars become more fuel efficient in that time, too. So we have that to look forward to in 2020. Oops. This is just so the prior slide was funding to the state overall for the highway program. This slide is just meant to give you a general idea that funding to local governments out of this bill will increase too. This is not just a state funding bill. I'll walk through a few of these programs here, but again, it's just meant to give kind of the general idea that local governments across the board will benefit from the funding increases in the FAST Act. So one thing I would point out is that not all local governments are created equal in the eyes of Congress. So if you see the top rectangle on those bars there, that's represented by the acronym there, TMA, that's a Transportation Management Area, and that's just another term for big MPO, so Metropolitan Planning Organizations over 200,000 in population. So we have three in Oregon, Portland Metro, Salem-Keizer, and Central Lane. And so if you happen to be a local government that falls within the boundaries of one of those large MPOs, you'll benefit not only from the funding increases I showed in the last slide, that 5% and then 2%, you're also getting a bigger slice of the pie. So they benefit from the overall funding growth, and Congress in this bill gave those areas a more favorable distribution of the surface transportation block grant program. So that's been consistent with congressional direction over the last couple of authorization bills. If you look back to just before the period when MAP 21, the prior authorization started in 2012, and then look forward to 2020, the last year of the FAST Act, funding in those large metro areas will have grown by 37%, while funding to the state overall will have grown by only 14%. So that's, again, pretty consistent with the approach Congress has taken in recent years.
I have to ask a question.
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
Okay, because, you know, you just keep going. So I had to, you just talked about the overall giving, you know, both to the state and to the local jurisdictions. And then you talked about one tool, which is block grants. And so are you talking about there being a formula? Block grants, what else? What are the tools?
There is the core, Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, the core of the federal funding program is apportioned to each state by formula. Mm-hmm. And within your kind of given formula amount, which for Oregon is somewhere between $400 and $500 million in over the next couple of years, that apportionment is broken down into specific programs, which are essentially block grant programs. There are strings attached, but the reason I use the term surface transportation block grant program is in the bill, in the FAST Act, Congress changed the name of the surface transportation program, the STP, as folks know it, to the surface transportation block grant program.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that you weren't talking about a multitude of new tools that I didn't know about. So it's formula and block grant program.
Right. They're the programs within the overall formula portion.
Okay. Thank you.
ODOT also shares a large amount of the federal apportioned funding with local governments, and those programs are governed, and this is for governments, I should say, outside of those large MPOs. So you'll see the next two items on the working our way down the bars there, the STP, Surface Transportation Program, to cities and counties and local bridge program. Those are federal revenues that ODOT shares with local governments by agreement. So we negotiate agreements with AOC and LOC to share those revenues with local governments outside the those large MPOs, and amounts in those agreements will track pretty closely with the funding growth in the last slide as well. As a general matter, funding increases across the board to local governments as well as to the state. So one of the key areas of reform from ODOT's perspective in the FAST Act relates to freight. It's been a topic of conversation for a number of years at the federal level about the need to create a standalone program for funding freight projects, because freight mobility is so important to economic vitality nationwide. So there actually was a fair amount accomplished on the subject in the bill. the first element here, and this was kind of between the House version and the Senate version of the bill, as the bill evolved late last year, they had kind of different approaches, and in the end, both approaches got included in the bill. So in the Senate bill, the DRIVE Act, which was passed first last summer, they included this formula program. So an additional formula program to the kind of the core of the federal funding program for funding freight projects. So this is a new program, and ODOT will get a new apportionment in each year of the bill for funding freight projects, about $14.5 million on average. It's meant to, because it's freight focused, I think Congress took an approach to really restrict where states can invest the money. So in Oregon, it's called the National Highway Freight Network, which in Oregon is primarily the interstate system. There are a few connectors to local roads and to port facilities, but for the most part, it's the interstate system. And we'll have an opportunity to add a little bit of mileage around the margins here and there over the course of the bill. But for now, the most part, it's restricted to the interstate system. But within that restricted network of roads, there's pretty broad project eligibility on the sorts of things we can invest the money in, typical bridge and auxiliary lane-like projects you might expect, intelligent transportation system-type projects, truck parking projects. There really is a lot you can do, but again, on a really constrained network of roads. And that also extends to, it's not just construction funding. Funding can be used for project development, too, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We do have to make some updates to the state freight plan in order to retain our ability to invest the money, and that process is underway, and we're working hard to meet those deadlines. The other component that I mentioned as it relates to freight is the Fast Lane Grant Program. So this was the House's approach. This was the Senate preferred the formula program, and the House kind of went with this competitive grant program. And if you're familiar at all with USDOT's Tiger Grant Program, this is very similar in terms of scale, in terms of competitiveness to the Tiger program, but there are a few differences. So for the most part, it's a program geared toward funding very large freight-related projects. And by very large, they mean over $100 million in total cost. There are set-asides for small projects, for rural projects, for multimodal projects. But for the most part, the bulk of the program is for those really big $100 million plus projects. There's $800 million available nationwide this year, and $850 next year, and so on up to $1 billion. Dollars in the last year of the bill. When the grant announcement came out, we kind of read through it, and it turned out to be pretty prescriptive. And so, working through all the different requirements in the bill, whether it's project readiness, whether it's match, we kind of had to work through that and see which projects we might have that could possibly be competitive. So ultimately, our commission decided on submitting three applications for the Fast Lane Grant Program this year. One is a $150 million project with a $50 million contribution from Fastlane, $50 million ask from Fastlane, to expand and retrofit the I-205 Abernathy Bridge. Another is about a $20 million overall project with a little over $5 million Fastlane request to construct a truck climbing lane on I-84 through Ladd Canyon between LeGrand and North Powder. And here in Salem, a $48 million overall project with a $20 million Fastlane contribution to expand I-5 in South Salem between the Kubler Interchange and Delaney Road. So those are the three that were settled on this year. There will be four more rounds in the future. And so certainly several bites at the apple, and hopefully we'll be successful in bringing some additional federal funds back to the state through that program. There were a number of other new grant programs created in the bill. One to test new, they call them surface transportation funding alternatives, so alternatives to the gas tax, which I talked a little bit about earlier, which is a tailor-made program to fund something like our Origo Road User Charge Program. There's also another new program to test new technologies, which I think you'll be hearing about some of the technologies a little bit later, but we are putting together an application to do a further build-out of some of these intelligent transportation system elements and try and win funding through the congestion management technology deployment program. Again, being very aggressive about bringing new and additional federal dollars back to the state through these grant programs. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Paul.
Good. Again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. Trevor just went through kind of the program, the additional funds. So the question, how does this roll into our programs, both our existing STIP, our capital program, and then our future STIP, and what does that look like in terms of amount of projects that are out there in our program? So our STIP, or our capital program, we have one currently approved by our commission. It's the 1518 STIP. We went through our usual kind of bottoms-up process through area commissions and various advisory committees to develop that. Now we have new funding to amend that STIP with, and I'll talk about how we went through and made those amendments and additions to that STIP. And then we have, looking ahead, the 1821 STIP. We're kind of midstream in the development of that STIP. And so we have to adjust, tweak some of our processes to account for some of the freight components and other components in the bill, but also for the additional funding. So I'll quickly just kind of walk through what we're doing there. So in the additional revenue in our existing STIP, the 1518, first there's a component of what we call Fix-It, our bridge and Prez projects that we have. Our commission anticipated the bill passing, and just to help get us working on those projects and making sure we can meet the obligation requirements in this year and in the next 2 years, they actually approved several projects back in October for additional bridge and preservation projects. What we've been working on them over the last several months with is the more the enhanced side of the equation, and the freight projects in particular in the bill. And this is a list of projects that we presented to the commission. The bolded projects on here are those freight projects that Trevor talked about. And again, these projects are essentially limited to the interstate system. Currently, we'll have more latitude as we go through the bill to make adjustments to our freight system as described in the FAST Act. But for now, we're essentially limited to the interstate system, and those are those bolded projects. The projects that aren't bolded are additional projects that the commission approved, and I would say kind of strategic areas. And so you'll see up there the cable barrier projects that I talked about earlier that filled out the balance of I-84. You'll also see some work on some seismic work on 97 to start the implementation of our seismic plan are there. But in the back to the bolded projects or the freight projects, you'll see many of those are development. They're really trying to line us up for those further rounds of the FAST Act, not just the one that's going on now and the projects that Trevor talked about. But as we go forward, we need to position ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities, apply for grants. And those are projects that the commission put some money for, so we can begin developing those, understanding more around how we can phase them, what are the true costs, what we should be applying for, what are the other leverage opportunities with other with the community or with other projects that we may have in our program. And you'll see all three of the projects that Trevor described in the current round are listed in here to help provide match for those projects. So that's 1518, and then so folding into our 1821 STIP, which again we're kind of midstream in the development of the commission, you'll see in the Fix-It side pointed additional funds in that area, again focused on a couple strategic areas, one being seismic. That additional amount of seismic funds, along with what they previously approved in 1821, will complete all the bridge work on 97 and the bridge work needed for seismic on Highway 58. So it starts to build that backbone kind of on the east side, reaching into the west side of Oregon to begin to get us ready for seismic. On the enhanced side, we have a current process underway for enhanced non-highway that our area commissions are working through. This just gave our area commissions a little more money to kind of move their cut line further down the list to get to more projects. The freight projects, we still need to go through a process for that $49 million to kind of vet those projects through process, and we need to do our work on our freight plan and our bottleneck study before we get to that. The last category, the strategic investment, this is really money the commission set aside, again, for us to provide additional match on those projects that we may apply for in the further round of the fast lane, just to give them some flexibility to be able to ensure we have the right match, as it's going to be a very competitive process, and I would anticipate the projects that are selected are going to be overmatched in a pretty significant way, and so give the commission some ability to point those $25 million into areas that seem to be the most likely for success on the grant program. Close just with the mountain chart. You've seen us talk about this in the past, just kind of looking back through our various programs, starting with the OTIA program back in 2001, OTIA 3 in 2003, and then currently the JTA program. That blue block at the bottom, that's the federal program. That's what Trevor and I have been talking about. It's kind of the bread and butter of our program that we have. What you see there kind of hashed in that kind of trapezoid-looking area there, the FAST Act, that's the increase that we've seen. So it's not a big increase, as we've been saying. Really, the news for us is stability. Now we can plan out till 2021 to do a better job in preparation for those consultants, contractors, our program. We have a better kind of stability, at least in those for the next 5 years, in understanding what our program's going to look like.
Questions? Representative McLean.
It's not really a question, I don't think. We'll see. I guess I could start with what could be almost a question, and that is the Transportation Commission about 2 years ago gave a vision to this committee to look at the future and to look at how the system they hoped would be a balanced system, you know, of a variety of things besides construction projects. And so the slide right before this one, where you were talking about those different categories, are those categories of the federal grant program, FAST grant program, or are those categories from the commission's goals and visions?
Ms. Chair, Representative McLean, it's a mixture of both, though. So these are the freight program, for example, is prescribed in the bill and sets the amount that we have to spend in the freight program, but such as enhanced non-highway is an area that the commission is focused on to provide that diverse transportation system that you described. So it's a mixture of both of their priorities. Seismic is another one. It's clearly a commission priority that they have in direction that they got from the governor last fall to focus on that. So it's a mixture of what's in the bill and then what their priority or vision is.
It's matching up the commission's goals with the actual potential grant possibilities.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, that slide says additional allocations. So how much is the additional as a percentage?
Well, you can kind of see on the mountain chart slide. So what we're allocating out is what's in the hashed area that we have. And so our existing program is what's below that amount. I don't have the exact number of what's in our existing program. It's broken out into several different categories. But what we're describing is how we're spending that additional funds that are in the FAST Act.
Follow up. If we can go back to the previous slide, the areas broken out, fix it, enhance, freight, strategic, do you have a similar mountain chart for need in those areas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we don't have a mountain chart broken out like that, but the presentation, if you haven't seen it yet, on the Governor's Vision group outlines the needs in those areas. Needs in fix it, needs in enhance, needs in different modes. I guess point you in that direction for what the need looks like.
Follow up. Yeah. So let's just use fix it for a second. The question there is, with that additional money, does that fix it? Can we forget about it now?
Yeah.
We've just got this additional whatever that is, $100 million bucks up there. Does that pretty well fill that need?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, no. We have much more needs in our bridge and pavements that we have. This will help, but in no way will it keep us from heading into a future of pretty dire bridge and pavement needs that we see coming, particularly on the bridge side, of just the age, the population of our bridges. Our program now is aimed almost exclusively on repairs and not replacements, just to keep the condition. You can't do that long term. Long term, we need to be in a position where we're replacing bridges and getting some new, younger bridges into our population. We're not in that situation, and this funding won't change that. We're still in a mode of just keeping bridges standing, and we're not going to be able to do that forever.
Final follow-up. Can you give us a rough statement? Are we meeting half of the need? Are we meeting two-thirds of the need? Can you give us an estimate?
So I'll give you an example on the bridge, Mr. Chair, Representative Ben. So on the bridge side, our need is roughly in the $240 million a year is what we should be spending on our bridges. Currently, with this new funding, we're about $75 million a year is what we're spending on our bridges.
Thank you.
Can I?
Representative McClain.
So the... When you are that, I really appreciate that question. And when you are looking again at the need, are you also looking at the prioritized, you know, projects because of that need? So, for example, you just used bridges, and you're saying that you've got like $75 million of $240 million to actually, you know, really fix it. So, how are you prioritizing for emergency or for, you know, what has to go first? What's the priority? As far as the $75 million being spent, what is your criteria?
Mr. Chair, Representative McClain, there's a number of different factors. For example, one of those is our very, very large bridges, the Astoria Bridge, the Fremont Bridge. Those are bridges we can't afford not to take care of, or load post, or just not take care of. So they get prioritized in a way a little bit higher than the rest. We also pay attention to corridors. We just can't blindly go down a worst first list, which could ultimately end up in the entire system being limited for truck usage because every route has a bridge on it. Mm-hmm. That's one thing in the OTO3 program became very clear to us working with industry. There's a set of routes that we need to make sure that from a condition standpoint or freight standpoint that we're able to keep those things. But those are just two of many different factors that we fold in. The bottom line is you fold all those needs into the $75 million, you don't get to a place where you can do any replacements.
Mm-hmm. Can I just have my last one is just that, thank you, and the strategic investment, which I think is what you were describing there,
right,
that if you only have the $75 million, you've got to make the strategic investment on what's going to do the best job of completing something,
right,
corridor, big project, whatever. And because the other way, it looks just like a patchwork quilt of, okay, we're going to stop that, and we're going to fill that, and we're going to patch that,
right,
and we don't. You know, I mean, I know that's not how you function, but I just think it's important for the public to understand that because the numbers look like, well, we're not going to be able to even come close to
right.
doing the job.
Right.
So how did you decide how to go forward?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative McClain, I'll just give you one consequence of kind of that approach on the pavement side. So obviously with the high speeds on the interstate, the high volumes on the interstate, that's our highest priority to take care of pavements and keep those as smooth and functioning as possible. As you go down our system, the district highways, as we call them, kind of the lowest tier of those, are the ones that are really going to suffer and are suffering now as we have not as much money to take care of those roads. Many of those roads are downtown roads, old Highway 30, old Highway 99 through different communities that are on the bottom of our priority list. But in those communities, those are main streets, and those are the highest priority for those. Mm-hmm. Thus, the whole conversation about orphan highways, around whether we should, as a state, still own those and why they're in the state of condition that they are, creates another policy decision for us to continue to talk about.
Thank you, gentlemen. Trevor, what's the timeline on the competitive grants and when we may know which of those we receive?
That is an excellent question, Mr. Chair. We don't quite know yet, because it's particularly for Fastlane, it's year one of the program, and there are some interesting requirements. So separate and apart from the FAST Act, the appropriations committees in Congress in the omnibus spending bill for 2016 included a requirement in there that all discretionary grant funds had to be awarded by September 1st of this year. So there's that hard deadline. But also within the FAST Lane program, within the FAST Act, the Congress included a 60-day congressional notification of awards. So USDOT will have to go through their process, which, based on my recent meetings with them, they're not terribly far along in, because they've got, I think, 212 applications nationwide, something like $9 billion worth of projects to sort through. But the answer I got from them a couple of weeks ago was they weren't really certain how to handle that congressional notification piece, if they just need to kind of quietly send a list over to the committees, if they need to announce it publicly. But if you start walking back 60 days from September 1st, I heard, that they wouldn't exactly commit to a deadline, but they said early summer for Fastlane. And the other grants, we submitted a grant through that for Origo through that funding program. It closed a little bit later, so I think it'll probably be out closer into August when we hear on that. And the technology deployment congestion management grant program, that is still open for another couple of weeks. So I think there will be a lot of news over the summer between now and September 1st.
And to put things in scale, you said there were $9 billion of asks for 850 million or 800 million?
800.
Yeah, so one out of every 10 projects, maybe, is in proportion. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to this exact issue, Senator Merkley was in Ontario last week, and I asked him if it would do any good for us to ask his office to weigh in with USDOT on these kind of things. His answer was maybe. Is that the right answer? Does it do any good to call us, our senators, and say, run down there and yell at U.S. Department of Transportation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I can tell you that Senator Merkley did supply letters of support for all three of the applications that we sent in through the Fastlane grant program, so he is on record in support of each of the projects. But I also, I don't think it ever hurts to have folks weigh in when it comes to a competitive grant program, and they don't always want to hear from us as the applicants, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to advocate for projects.
Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate it. Okay, now we're going to move to a discussion regarding autonomous and connected vehicles. Let's begin the panel with Jerry Bohard from the Department of Transportation, and then we'll do a panel of three after that. And I think we can all continue to see presentation without blinds closed and
yes,
lights.
That was driving me crazy.
So let's just leave it all on. And if you have trouble seeing it, you can look it on your computer. Lights up, windows open, let's turn the music on. It's 9 o'clock hearing.
Is this a sunshine law?
This is it. We are opening this building to the public.
Good morning, Chair Davis, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohard. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator. And so I think something a little bit different than what you just heard this morning, we're going to talk about technology. So I just want to take a few minutes, maybe set the stage a little bit, because I know you have some excellent speakers coming behind me, to really talk about what is the agency doing in preparing for this new technology. And I think you'll see that we're trying to be proactive, but really trying to find that balance as we move forward. So just want to take 2 seconds, because a lot of times we sort of intermingle the word connected and automated or autonomous vehicles, and really sort of highlight some of the differences between them about how they think about technology. I think the real important one on connected vehicles is that they rely on wireless communication, send messages to other vehicles or to our roadside infrastructure. This could be some of the safety stuff around potential collisions, provide warnings to drivers. The vehicles may also be connecting to our roadway infrastructure, receiving messages about speed limits, and we've heard a lot about that this morning, traffic incidences, slowdowns, all in preparation for what may be coming up ahead. We also are seeing stuff like on the anti-lock brakes, they can give you status about what's the pavement, so whether it's slick or not, which, given the conditions that we have here in Oregon, could be very helpful. So the difference in the automated vehicles is this is where something is being performed by the vehicle versus the driver. And some of this stuff we already sort of take for granted. Those of us with automatic transmission, cruise control, right, and some in the newer vehicles with our parking assist and some of the lane stuff as well. So you're starting to see some more automation coming around that folks aren't actually sort of recognizing are moving the vehicles. So this is just kind of a sense of some of the connected vehicle applications you might see. If you look in the center, this is where the vehicle is just sort of warning about those, you know, with your blind spot. So when it's unsafe to change lanes, you might see the car at the bottom. It's issuing a brake light warning. So for vehicles that are unable to actually see the car braking, they're being informed that a slowdown is happening and they're able to take those precautions. The vehicle in the upper left is actually just talking to the parking structure and saying, is there parking available? So they're not wasting the time driving around or driving through the parking structure. Bus, variety of things could be happening there, obviously with what's going on with the cars, but perhaps getting some priority to actually move through the traffic signal. And then the others you might not see as well is the little cyclist next to there might have something on his smartphone making the bus be aware of that vulnerable user. That's also in the intersection. So you can see a lot can be happening in the intersection those of us, you know, as a person, often just catch about half of that of what's going on. Versus what you look for in the level of automation. So this is from the U.S. Department of Transportation. You can see sort of that level zero, that where the driver is complete control of all the functions at all the time. Where you get down to sort of that level two and three. So in level two, this is where you have sort of two control functions being used in combination. So the adaptive cruise control, so where the car is making sure that the distance between two vehicles is kept correctly, and then making sure that the vehicle is staying in its lane. As you move into three, you start to see more of the Google car. So you see more of the safety initiatives being handled by the vehicle. It's not to get to level four where you sort of see that the driver is really no longer needed and the car is able to do what the car needs to do. I think in where we feel we are right now, and I think you may hear from the speakers, we're probably in that two to three. And then I think the big question is what's the timing as these move forward? And you may hear from the speakers a whole lot of different assumptions about how quickly things are happening. So what does this mean to the agency? So we've been spending some time, and we know, while we have a fairly comprehensive list, and I'll show you a little bit of our work program in a minute, we recognize the changes are going to be happening that we're not even aware of, that are not only going to change how we think about the transportation system, but think about what we look like as an organization. Think about what the skills our staff are going to need as we move forward in this technology. So there's a lot of unknowns that are out there, and we're trying to at least be prepared for them and think about them, but recognize that we have a long ways to go. Traffic data. So, for instance, in the case of traffic data, because of the Bluetooth activity, because of the information that we're getting from private, we're getting more data that's continuous and that's more accurate about the vehicles that are moving on our system. But there's a question about, okay, so how do we use that? How do we analyze that? And how do we take advantage of the information that's there? So those are all some of that continuity that we still need to work on. Incident response. So as these vehicles move forward, we're hoping to see fewer and less severe crashes. So what does that mean when we think about incident response? Certainly our roadway design and our safety features, when we think about guardrails and rumble strips, even our lane widths, how do those transform and look different as we move into the future, depending on what happens with these vehicles? Certainly our signal infrastructure becomes very important when we're thinking about these connected vehicles. So how does that need to change over time? How do we prepare for that? And so the list just goes on, even the work that we do relative to public transportation. So what have we done? So I'm currently serving as chair of our CAV steering committee, and I'll talk a little bit about how that came about in just a minute. But you can really see what I really want to send with this list is the diversity across the agency that's represented on here. So everything from transportation development, which includes, for me, includes data, includes planning, includes research, safety division, information services, so certainly what's happening. So our CIO sits on this committee. And this is really sort of the top leadership that is sitting on this committee, which we couldn't do without the support of all the resources throughout the agency. So the message here is that it's cross-cutting across with the work that we do. We also just recently hired our policy advisor, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I believe he's in the audience. So Andrew's right there. He's been with the agency for about 2 months now, I believe. So just to step back, and actually Paul Mather actually worked on this strategic initiative, was to what do we need to be thinking about? What are kind of the areas that we need to concentrate on? So really the first one was around agency readiness. So that was led us to put together the CAV steering committee. It led us to the recognition that with so much going on, we really needed someone who could sort of keep track of everything and help us move forward, which was why we hired a policy advisor. So we're going to be relying a great deal on Andrew as we go forward. The other is, and I wasn't involved in this, but we actually did a full-day workshop looking at what are some of the future connected vehicle applications that we need to be thinking about. How do we prioritize those so our work the next couple years is helping to facilitate that conversation. And I think finally, just engage nationally. There's a lot that's going on with various DOTs. Certainly you're going to hear from the businesses today and the work that they're doing. And so we just need to take advantage of what's happening at the other DOTs and the things that they're concentrating on as we move forward. So this is, we call this our business investment map, another fancy word in some respects for a work program. Just the recognition, these are, if you drill deeper into this, we sort of have a list of things to do behind each of those. Collaborate with others. So the recognition that as we think about communication, it's not only within our agency, it's with our local governments and our other partners, as well as the public. And so we're just starting now to sort of develop some of those key messages and think of what that communication structure should look like. Transportation system planning, I guess one near and dear to my heart. We'll have to be figuring out what our planning might look like and how it might look different. Certainly one of the things that we're doing now is actually scenario planning, so sort of recognizing what are some of the plausible futures that could happen. So really sort of paying attention to indicators versus saying this is the way planning is going to happen. It's more about here's the types of plausible futures that could happen, and here's the indicators that we need to pay attention to as we move forward. As I mentioned, cultural and workforce readiness. So this is going to change our agency. The skills that we're going to need within for our staff is going to look different, so we need to be paying attention to that. Talked a little bit about data. I talked a little bit about some of our strategic assessments. Some of the things that we're working on right now, and I think you may hear from one of the speakers, that we're trying to get more information on, freight platooning. So how quickly is that going to happen? What are the impacts potentially to the agency? How do we need to be prepared? So that was just one that we recognized we needed to get more information on as we move forward. The other around legal and regulatory, I think you all are aware that some states have started to do legislation around automated vehicles. The American Association, it's not a group I work with, American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, so kind of the national DMV folks, they've been actually working on model legislation, so they get some consistency across the states. So our DMV staff is staying actively engaged in that. So as we get questions, we can bring forward some recommendations there. So we recognize that there's a lot of work that we have yet to do. We recognize there's a lot of questions that we don't even know are out there yet. But with that, I'll turn it over to some of the speakers that you have coming next.
Questions for Jerry?
I can wait.
All right. Well, we have a three-member panel that I'd like to ask to join us. And why don't you each introduce yourselves, and you can go in any order in which you so choose. So come on up, all three of you.
Do either of you have presentations?
No, I don't.
Okay. So I'll sit over here then, because I do.
Thank you. And why don't you each introduce yourselves first, and then we can just start from right to left down the line. Or unless there's an order you'd prefer to go in.
I was anticipating going last.
Very good. We'll start from left to right. Excellent.
I am also the only one that actually has a PowerPoint presentation, and they might have both been planning on more Q&A. I'm not quite sure if you have talking pieces as well.
That's okay. Go ahead and introduce yourselves, and then we'll start from left to right.
Thank you, Chairman Davis. My name is Harry Lightsey. I'm Executive Director of Global Public Policy for General Motors.
Okay.
Hello. Good morning, Chair. My name is Suman Narayanan. I'm representing Daimler Trucks North America. I'm responsible for advanced driver assistance and safety systems engineering.
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I'm Adrian Piermine. I'm the National Director for Smart Cities and Connected Vehicles for the transportation consulting firm DKS Associates. And what I was asked to brief you on today was a Smart Cities Challenge that the US DOT put out recently, and Portland's response to that, and then kind of how it relates to the state a little bit.
Very good. Adrian?
Thank you. Again, good morning, Chairman Davis and members of the committee. It's certainly an honor to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you this morning and express General Motors' views on this rapidly developing topic of autonomous or self-driving vehicles. As a leader in automated driving technology, General Motors is redefining the industry's approach to personal mobility. Across the globe, social and technological changes are transforming personal transportation. General Motors is at the forefront of these developments, particularly with regard to automated driving technology, which has the potential to make transportation safer and more accessible. When it comes to automated driving technology, our efforts are built on the same bedrock principles of safety, which remains our top priority. Recent United States statistics indicate that more than 2 million vehicle crashes occur annually, resulting in over 32,000 fatalities on the United States roads and highways every year. According to the most recent government data, more than 94% of these crashes are caused by human error. The promise of highly automated driving systems is that they can significantly decrease human driving error and corresponding vehicle crashes. With so much at stake, General Motors seeks to build upon its strong track record with automated driving technology research. In fact, many of today's active safety features, such as full speed range adaptive cruise control and lane keeping assist, are steps toward autonomous driving. With these features, we're gaining a deeper understanding of how we can introduce automated driving technology as safely and quickly as possible. We have recently made investments in the ride-sharing company Lyft, and we acquired a company called Cruise Automation, both of which demonstrate General Motors' leadership commitment. Cruise Automation's deep software talent and rapid development capability, combined with our resources and expertise, will further accelerate our process. Our partnership with Lyft also complements our expertise in automated driving by providing a ride-sharing platform to support potential deployment programs. All of these developments demonstrate General Motors' commitment to this technology. General Motors is accordingly grateful for the opportunity to highlight what we think to be the best regulatory path forward for automated driving technology. The overriding regulatory objective should be to foster automated vehicle deployment as safely and as rapidly as possible. We believe the most effective way to do this is to authorize publicly available on-demand ride-sharing, car-sharing, or similar platforms through shared automated vehicle projects. The projects could be offered in geographically bounded areas that might include urban residential areas, business districts, or university campuses, or under other appropriate conditions as determined necessary for safe operation, such as weather conditions, speed limits, and types of roads. These projects will allow the public to experience automated driving technology in a safe and controlled manner while developing the data to inform further policy developments. This will also facilitate harmonization between states and the federal government, which will be key to ensuring that this technology becomes a practical reality. This style of deployment also encourages partnership with local and state governments, which will help ensure full public benefit from the technology. I want to be clear that safety is a critical focus of these opportunities. Automated driving technology has the potential to significantly improve mobility for all people, and it must be developed carefully, keeping the public and their safety in mind. In closing, General Motors enthusiastically supports policy initiatives to accelerate the development and adoption of safe, high-level vehicle automation through real-world projects. We look forward to working with policymakers to spur developments of these technologies as safely and as rapidly as possible. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that your presentation, and I just want to make sure I understand the strategy, the rollout strategy. So what you were talking about is first in these communities and that providing opportunities for people to use this technology by, I'm not going to call it renting a car, but some other vehicle other than their own, where they would use the transport to go to the store or to the bank or something. So is that what you're talking about, where you would first roll it out?
Correct. So, for example, you could have a ride-sharing fleet in the urban corridor of a city like Portland or Salem. You can make that available to the public where they don't have to make the significant investment to actually purchase a vehicle to experience the technology. And at the same time, the manufacturer continues to own the vehicle and is responsible for the maintenance of the vehicle and keeping the vehicle operating in a safe manner. And so that actually provides the limits on the use of the technology that allow us to then move more quickly, because we don't have to anticipate, you know, that anybody is going to be in one of these vehicles anywhere.
Representative McLean.
Okay, so I understand that you believe that the technology is safer than real people driving. And so General Motors, in having these fleets in these populated areas that somebody could call up on a platform and call to them, and then the car drives itself to the to this person, correct?
Correct.
And so you said you were going to be responsible for maintenance of the car. What about insurance? And just in case there might be a little glitch in one of the programs that is in this self-driven car?
Yeah, so I think it's important to understand that this is like we're still at the very beginning. And in order to do this safely, we have to make sure that each step along the way is fully supported by what the technology is capable of at that point in time and for the public safety. And so we won't see initial deployments with cars without drivers in them. We anticipate that the initial deployments will have what we call a safety driver in the vehicle until we can accumulate enough data to establish that these vehicles are in fact safer than vehicles being driven by human drivers. So we intuitively feel that with 94% of crashes being caused by human error, that there is an opportunity here to have a significant impact on safety. But because we don't have any real world experience with the technology, we really don't know that. So what we believe is we need to go incrementally and use that opportunity to develop the data that supports moving on to the next phase.
So I think your answer was that you would be covering your safety driver with insurance, and that you would be taking care of any crashes that did happen.
Correct.
As far, it would be your responsibility.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's why, that's another reason why we feel that these ride-sharing projects offer the opportunity for initial deployments, because you have a substantial company like the automobile manufacturer that continues to own the cars, stands behind their performance, is responsible for anything that occurs with the vehicle.
Thank you.
Vivek.
Thank you, Chair. As it relates to insurance, I'm just curious, is the insurance industry at the table in these conversations? And if so, if and when it's determined that this is actually a safer way to drive, will there be incentives or reduced rates for consumers who have these type of vehicles? Or have you had any conversation about that?
So I think, you know, I don't want to speak for the insurance industry, and I'm not here to do so, but I think the insurance industry is looking at the potential for these technologies very carefully and trying to assess how that may impact their business. I think they need to see data as well that establishes the safety record for these types of vehicles before they can start to make judgments on how that impacts policies and that kind of thing. So I think they're looking forward to having the opportunity to see the data as well.
Thank you.
What's the time frame on when we might see the beginning deployments of this sort of arrangement and technology?
So as with many technologies, the initial phases are the most expensive. The cost of the sensor arrays that are used for high-level automated vehicles is certainly significant. That's another reason why we feel like these ride-sharing projects could be something that could rapidly accelerate, because you're not asking people to step up and purchase a car at a significant expense. They have the opportunity to experience, and frankly, we have the opportunity to gauge whether people are willing to get into a car with that level of high level of automation. We don't really know what public acceptance of these technologies will be. So we believe that with ride sharing, where the manufacturer continues to own the car, we don't have to worry about designing and selling a car at retail and competitive pricing. We believe that this could start to happen in as soon as a couple of years. There has been a very rapid change in the progress of this technology. I think a few years ago, people would have told you we were decades away, and I think now there is a consensus that we are simply a few years away.
Thank you. Simon?
Hello. Daimler Trucks North America, as you know, is headquartered here in Portland, Oregon. We belong to the Daimler AG business unit. In North America, Daimler Trucks has about 40% market share. It is one of the largest class 6, 7, and 8 truck manufacturers. And globally, if you combine it with Mercedes trucks and Fuso trucks in Japan, it is globally the largest commercial vehicle manufacturer. Having said that, Daimler also enjoys its collaboration with Mercedes cars. So you can expect there is a lot of technology that is developed under the Mercedes car umbrella that gets trickled down to the trucks and the bus division. So now that I've given you a complete overview of what the organization is and how we are connected, just to give you a little bit of numbers, annually about 350,000 Class A trucks are sold, and North America has about 3 million Class A trucks that are running roughly on the roads. So roughly, a truck lasts for about 10 years. That is what you can imagine. And in the recent years, we have started introducing stage one autonomous, as it was shown before. So you would have adaptive cruise control and automatic emergency braking, both of which are currently offered with radar technology that are out there as an option that customers can choose. So if you look at a technology deployment roadmap, we started offering this in trucks somewhere in the 2000s. At that point, it was still radar-based, but it was a warning-only system. So if the system detects a potential collision, it would give the driver an audible and acoustic warning. But ultimately, it depended on the driver to make the final judgment. And since then, the technology has evolved, and also the confidence in these technologies have evolved so much that we are autonomously able to control the vehicle. So that is the roadmap, if you see, from 10 years ago to where we are today. So that is just the forward collision that we discussed. It's a radar that is able to look at metallic objects in front of it. And the technology of radar, although it's extremely old in most aspects, it has been also the most robust technology out there. It is immune to mostly the weather elements, and it is also one of the robust sensors that's out there. Hence, it has prevailed these decades. In addition to that, Daimler Trucks North America has also started looking, just like other truck manufacturers, into imaging system. So think about it as a camera that is mounted on the front of the vehicle, and it looks at lane markings, and it also looks at traffic signs, and it slowly evolves into looking at other objects, etc., adding confidence to not just one sensor, but two sensors are fusing together and giving the brains behind this automated driving a little bit more to work with. If you look at the portfolio of any Class 8, Class 6, 7 truck manufacturers, it is not just on-highway trucks, which is what you would normally see on highways with a trailer. Those are the long-haul trucks that is moving trailers from point A to point B. There, the business model is thrive on operational efficiency, keep the service costs low, and make sure that you're making per mile the cost. But that is not the only portfolio that we need to focus on. We also need to look at delivery type applications. So these are these smaller trucks, box trucks, that tend to deliver goods within the city limits. And there the game is slightly different. You're now engaging into city traffic, bicyclists, pedestrians, etc. So you can see that the technology that is extremely suitable for an on-highway application may not be the best when it comes to within city limits, etc. So that is the segment one, which is on highway. Then you look at the city traffic or delivery type applications. And then you look at vocational applications. These are the trucks that are equipped with cranes, any special cement mixer bodies or dump trucks, logging trucks, et cetera, et cetera. And now you look at, they don't even run on paved roads for most of these parts. If you think about it, a logging truck probably spends about 20% of the time off highway. A dump truck spends significant portion of its time off highway. So the technology at this point becomes extremely critical on what we choose based on what application. Mm-hmm. Now that I've given you an idea of where Daimler is, what our challenges are, I also want to give you some positive notes, which is when it comes to autonomous driving, you can just break it down to three pieces. There is a sensor portion of it, analogous to our eyes, ears, etc. And then there is an actuator portion of it at the end, which basically helps the vehicle slow down, move, etc. But then in between, the sensor and actuator is connected by the artificial intelligence. And to your earlier question, there was a point that you made. Are they going to be any good as a human? That is a challenge that we as engineers and developers are constantly faced with. Human brain is probably the most sophisticated computer that money cannot buy, unfortunately. Our job is to make sure that we get closer and closer to making these systems act as good as a human, in some cases even better than a human. So with that in mind, what we're working on right now is to make sure we focus on an accident-free driving condition. Daimler Trucks North America is not really focused on removing the driver from the equation when it comes to Class 6, 7, or 8 trucks. We want to make sure that we achieve an accident-free operating condition, may it be highway or road conditions. That is a primary objective. Second objective is to have operational efficiency at its peak. We want to give the drivers, we want to give the fleets enough technological support so they can achieve the maximum operational efficiency. And the third that we want to focus on is the driver comfort. Drivers who are behind the wheels for 8 hours and longer, we need to make sure that their lifestyle is not too different than anybody else's lifestyle. It needs to be a profession that people are sought to. Having said that, where are we today? If you think about technological advancements that we can make, there are some strengths that we as OEMs have. And then there is the legislation portion of it. That is where you have the leverage. And then there is a portion that neither of us really can control, which is the market acceptance or the customer acceptance. The point when these three things coincide, and that is when we have the most successful outcome. Mm-hmm. A great example where technology was great was a Google Glass, but then you couldn't wear that and go to a bar. You would be called a glass hole. Or you couldn't wear that and drive because you would get pulled over for wearing a device. So great technology alone cannot thrive. Great technology needs to be matched with legislation and also customer acceptance. With that, I would like to wrap my talk.
President Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's nothing worse than an engineer talking to we liberal arts majors. There's nothing worse. Nothing. So As we progress, this is actually a question for both of you, or maybe perhaps all of you, but the system becomes less independent and much more dependent. And so satellite systems and other things that make all of this work, the easy way to ask you to address that transition would be with a hacker problem. But another one would be where you want to jump in your car and drive away because of an emergency and all the other things are down, let's say an earthquake. Not that one would ever happen here, but if that were to, you know, happen, what happens to these systems? Can we hop in one of these cars and will it take us away, or is it all crashed?
Representative Benz, let me start with that point. With regard to cybersecurity and data security, that is definitely the most important part of any of these, and we have dedicated groups working towards cybersecurity. The existing open networks that are out there, vehicle networks, were never designed expecting these technologies to advance to where we are today. Therefore, the amount of technological advancement that you will see in cybersecurity and vehicle CAN security is going to be drastically changing in the coming years. And every OEM, GM, Daimler, we are all investing heavily in that area. So you can expect cars and trucks to be more robust than your bank accounts and your cell phones. That is a goal that we are working towards. Because a payload that a truck carries can be used in numerous ways, as you can imagine, to harm the greater of us. It is not just the lost money, but it is also holding fleets hostage to situations. So cybersecurity is an area that we are all investing. And to the second point, drivers should always be in control. When all these systems fail, somebody should be able to move a bus full of kids from the train tracks, because that is what the driver is paid to do. That is where the human brain kicks in and has the most suitable outcome. Cybersecurity, yes, we are all investing in, and driver as the ultimate decision maker is what trucks is focusing on currently. I hope that answers your question.
Right. So my father is 91 and he's in an assisted living center, and I've been suggesting to him that at some point in the next few years he'd be able to dial up a car, it would drive up, he'd walk out, he'd fall into it, and away they would go. And there wouldn't be a driver in that car. I'm just saying, that's how it's going to work. They're going to be a big fleet parked somewhere in town, and they're going to zoom off as someone orders one of them. I mean, that's been my vision of it. Am I wrong?
Should I pass it on to you?
Yes. So I think ultimately that is the vision. And that is one of the things that it holds out a great promise for folks who are disabled or elderly who've lost the opportunity for personal mobility, to bring that back to those populations. I think that's the vision. I think you know, how we get there is certainly something that all of the different OEMs have different paths that they're looking at. Certainly put forward the one that we think is the quickest to get there. Just to kind of add on to the previous discussion about cybersecurity, I think absolutely agree. Cybersecurity is a phenomenon that is the new norm in our industry, and we're all devoting a significant amount of resources to that. We have stood up an industry ISAC, which is provides for us to share cyber threat information with each other, so that if it is starting to impact one of us, we can share that with the rest of us and know about it. Under the umbrella of that ISAC, we're working on automotive industry best practices. SAE and other bodies are working hard on cybersecurity standards. So the industry is responding to this challenge very effectively, and we certainly agree with my friend here from Daimler that the vision is that these vehicles will be safer as a result of all that effort.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benz, if I may. So I'm a consultant in the industry. I'm not part of the OEM as a original equipment manufacturers, the traditional car manufacturers. If we had Google at the table, I think they would be giving you an even more aggressive approach and more aggressive timeline in terms of no drivers, and the type of scenario that you're talking about. And just so in regards to your question about dependence between the vehicle and the systems that it's communicating with, I think it was kind of the fundamental part of your question there. The vehicles that they're building and testing right now all over California are not really communicating with roadside infrastructure or the other existing systems down at the local level for the most part. They're really autonomous and self-contained vehicles. And so the vision of the future, as the DOT and other partner agencies do make investments in connected vehicle infrastructure alongside the roadway that's sending communications to these vehicles, that those cars will become autonomous and connected, and so they're getting more data and more information about the roadways and the road conditions and cars up ahead of them and whether lanes are closed. But those vehicles are also being designed not to rely on that connected vehicle communication. So they would probably answer that they would be able to evacuate even if the local infrastructure was not communicating.
Follow up. So is it correct? Should we be thinking that we're going to have fewer roads as a result of this because of the investment necessary to achieve that connectedness?
It's very hard for me to envision reducing our roads from where we are right now in the foreseeable future for decades and decades. Perhaps as we expand new communities, they might not need as much roadway infrastructure in the new communities, but I don't think we're going to eliminate anything.
So we've, agreed. I think a lot of this is information that we don't know yet. You know, we're at the very beginning of this, and this is all part of being able to move forward in the way that ensures public safety and builds the data that we need to start to make these kinds of choices. We understand that our folks and the friends in the Departments of Motor Vehicle in the states, such as Oregon, you know, are making choices where they have to try to figure out, you know, 30, 40 years from now what's the world going to look like. And those are very difficult choices, especially given the pace of change with regard to these technologies. I've seen studies where, and there are policy choices to be made also. So I've seen studies where cities, depending on the policy choices that a city makes, you know, anywhere from saying, you know, we're just going to continue to allow folks with individually owned personal vehicles to move through the city as they do now, to all the way to saying we're not going to allow individual vehicles in the downtown core area. We're going to limit that to public transportation and ride-sharing type of applications. The difference between the landscape and those two scenarios is significant in terms of the safety impacts, the impacts on the roads, the amount of space you need because ride-sharing vehicles don't need parking, so that frees up parking spaces that are dedicated real estate today, creates opportunity for narrower roads and wider sidewalks, bicycle lanes, all of those kind of things. So a lot of it depends on the policy choices.
I mean, it sounds, it's breathtaking and sounds like Jetsons on, steroids. But it's one of those things where I don't think that the one question that Representative Benz answered, because I thought you answered everything else beautifully, but the one thing, and I think you tried to answer it, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear about it, and that is if there is a failure of system, I don't care what that failure of system is. I mean, it's basically, it could be the actual technology. It could be the circumstance. It could be, the source of being able to use that technology. But is the vehicle going to be able to handle a 91-year-old man who was just falling into this car? If everything goes down, you say you need time to test that. Well, do we want that man in that car while you're testing, but still, I mean, is there some way to override?
Yeah, so I think certainly, as I said, public safety and safety is our top priority in all of this. So our job, before we put a vehicle out there for the public to use it, just like today, but with regard to these vehicles as well. Our job is to design that vehicle to protect the public safety. So, you know, we have to design a system. First of all, we have to limit the amount of opportunities there are for the system to fail. But we also have to design the system so that if the system does fail, there's a safe way to handle that situation. And we believe that, you know, that's certainly our engineering challenge to do that. But we believe we've met those challenges for the 100 years of our industry to the best engineering standards, and we're committed to continuing to do that.
Representative McMahon, to that question, recently we were looking at driver state monitoring. Once again, Daimler Trucks North America is not working on removing the driver from the equation. We want to go up to stage 3 autonomous, but driver still is remaining. In that example where there is someone who's disabled, even though that person might be a passenger or might be the stage 3 autonomous driver, we want to be able to monitor the driver's state. So there are situations where truck drivers have experienced heart attack or seizure that has caused some significantly bad outcomes. So by able to monitor the driver's state, a slow reduction in pulse or an impending health crisis, mm-hmm. we are able to control the vehicle, pull it over safely, send out a distress signal. And those are still the possibilities that we can exploit mm-hmm. With the help of these technologies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean, I think you're hitting on a fundamental point that the legislature is going to be wrestling with. And as you're thinking about setting new policy at the state level and working together with ODOT and Andrew Dick and the rest of the team there and trying to figure this out, the traditional auto manufacturing industry is taking a more conservative approach and incrementally working towards more full automation and is not particularly arguing that the steering wheel should be removed anytime in the future. Mm-hmm. You'll get a different answer from the disruptor community. And if we had Google or Uber or somebody like that up here with their robotics lab, they would be arguing that please don't put any legislation in that is explicit about a driver being able to take over control or having a steering wheel. So none of us represent that particular block, and I'm just throwing it out there because they would be.
Okay, thank you.
I will just to pile on, I will add that now we believe that so the whole idea of high-level automation, what we believe is the safety opportunity is those 94% of crashes that cause over 30,000 fatalities on our roads today. That's the opportunity. We believe that the opportunity is that there has to be a path validated by data and substantiated that it's safer for the vehicle to not have a driver in it than to have a human driver in it. But we believe that appropriate policy should have that path in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to talk a little bit about trucks. And Bob, I'm not picking on truck drivers, Bob Russell back there. But as I drive on the freeway and look at the number of trucks, so we're going to go back to how all this works together and the focus on safety, and the focus on trucks is safety. So part of that has to do with how close vehicles get, how long it takes them to stop, all of those things. So as I'm driving up the freeway and looking at the number of trucks in that, and I'm not suggesting they're driving too close now, but it may be as we design this technology in that we learn how much longer it takes to stop, I see a line of trucks with a few cars in between from here to the border in order, if we're going to meet all of those standards and do those things. So while we have the traffic that we have on the road today, and some what I've read, we may have more traffic with autonomous vehicles, but I'm trying to understand the relationship then between our efforts for trucks in particular to intermingle with all the other things on the road, meet the safety standards and do this stop and that, and not create what I see in the niche, even though it's safer, creates some all kinds of problems from a standpoint of moving our products to market. I mean, it seems to me there's some conflicts there. If I may start, Representative Lively, the platooning concept, it is not anything new. Anyone who's watched Tour de France knows that you follow someone really close, you have an advantage. So as fuel got expensive, you would have started seeing trailers with trailer skirts.
Mm-hmm.
All the wheels of the truck would have these discs. Some exclusive aero devices started showing up, all to get 0.1% of fuel economy benefit. And that adds up if you're a large fleet. And the next frontier right now is to cut on aerodynamics. Trucks have been made really smooth. Now the question is, if you can follow them really close, then you have a little bit more benefit. It improves operational efficiency. And if you think about that specific aspect, you have the technology today to make sure that if the lead truck detects anything that is going to cause it to slow down, that information is available instantaneously to the vehicles that are following. In the past, if you were to ask any seasoned truck driver, they would say at least 7 seconds following distance is what you should maintain to anticipate what is happening in front of you, apply the brakes. Depending on the road conditions, you will still not have a collision. That was what would be the answer. 7 second following distance is what you need to have when you're traveling 55 miles per hour. Now, if you have any truck, any standard truck with adaptive cruise control, the default is 3.5 seconds. Right away, you can see that it is getting closer, but 3.5 seconds is still quite a bit. You can have people cut in, and you can still adjust. And as you go into the platooning mode, it is closing in and closing in, almost 1 second following distance, or in some cases, even less than 1 second following distance is what we are trying to test so that we can get maximum efficiency in aerodynamics. But if you think about that 1 second, or I have been in a truck driving at 0.4 seconds following distance at 50 miles per hour in a test track, but with the technology and the rate at which we are developing it, it is not as dangerous as it sounds. We are able to detect the system. Because 0.4 in anybody's mind is like, I can't even react in 0.4 seconds, let alone the system reacting. But we are able to predict what the curvature of the road is with the help of GPS. We know that if I'm approaching a uphill, I need to space out a little bit because the truck in front of me is going to slow down as it climbs up a grade. Similarly, if you're going to go downhill, I need to space out. So we do have the technology that helps us from GPS perspective, in cameras perspective, and radar's perspective that helps us go after these scenarios.
But, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lively, that's half or three quarters of the answer to your question, and that's the safety in following one another. And I totally support everything that he just described from what I've seen in the research. But the other part of your question is, so that's great. Now do we create a wall of trucks that are all platooning and following each other? So if I'm trying to get onto I-84, I can't even get on because they're... So I think that's where the legislature, again, is going to probably need to work with the industry to figure out, do we allow platoons of such a distance but no more than two or three trucks? And then once there is a platoon of two or three, there needs to be separation of blank before the next platoon. I think that's the kind of policy that you guys are going to need to consider. But again, working with the industry to figure out what the right balance is. Is that fair?
Yeah. Good, thank you.
Okay. So I have a presentation. I'm going to try to actually breeze through this because there's a couple parts to the story that I think your group will be most interested in. I think a lot of it might be interesting generally, but not really going to affect upcoming policy, and so I'll try not to spend too much time on those pieces. The FAST Act was presented earlier in session, so I don't need to go over that. But one of the interesting things that came along with the FAST Act, about the same time that the act was announced, the U.S. Secretary Anthony Fox also announced the Smart Cities Challenge. And this challenge was a very unique funding opportunity and very innovative approach from the U.S. DOT. What the Secretary said was, the most innovative, most forward-looking plan to harness technology and reimagine how people will move will receive up to $40 million to become the first city to implement these smart city technologies. And then Vulcan Inc., who is the company from Paul Allen's Microsoft fame and billions, has a separate investment company, added another $10 million match to this $40 million. To promote vehicle fleet electrification. So that can go into electrifying fleets, it can go into charging stations, and that kind of infrastructure. So what was unique about this is instead of the U.S. DOT taking $50 million and saying you get $5 million, you get $7 million, you get $10 million, and spreading it across multiple markets, they're going all in with one city. They also specified that they're targeting medium-sized cities to try to prove replicability across most of the country. And so they specified the cities need to be between 200,000 and 850,000 people. So that kicked out all the LAs and the Houstons and the Chicagos, but it left Portland's in the mix. After the original announcement, the USDOT worked together with several other private sector vendors and companies that have all come to the table and said, we want to partner along with this, and we'll put skin in the game as well. And I'll talk about a couple of these folks, but Mobileye Technologies is a company that does aftermarket vehicle automation, so we'll add systems and sensors and technology to a car that was not built with automation. And they have a specific product that and they've offered up millions of dollars of equipment into this partnership. NXP is a company that makes the connected vehicle radios that would go on your infrastructure or in the car itself and do the vehicle-to-vehicle or vehicle-to-infrastructure communications. They've ponied up a couple million dollars as well. Alphabet is the the new rebranding of Google. Alphabet's the overall umbrella, and Google is a company within the Alphabet. Sidewalk Labs is another company within within the Alphabet family that also joined and is offering hundreds of thousands to millions in terms of goods and services. So we're basically saying the pot is now up to about 70 million of I call it cash and prizes. The USDOT, when they put out this challenge, had 13 different areas that they wanted to see cities demonstrate. They tried very intentionally not to be overly prescriptive of what a smart city meant, but they wanted their cities to say what that means to them, what problems are our cities trying to solve. But they did want to see things like vehicle automation, things like connected vehicles and sensors were on the highest priority of the different vision elements that they wanted to see demonstrated, and they actually identified 12 other vision elements, including vehicle electrification, smart land use, connected citizens, urban delivery and logistics, and a whole bunch of different areas. They were overwhelmed by the success of the project. They had made the pot big enough that everyone could not resist throwing in a proposal. And this slide says 77 applications. I believe it was 79 cities finally ended up applying to this program. It was their intention to shortlist that original list of cities down to five finalists, and they were going to give those five finalists each $100,000 and a couple more months to go back and refine their story and submit a final proposal. Because they were so overwhelmed and so impressed with the proposals, they said, they picked seven finalist cities instead of the five that they had originally planned. And you can see here that we were successful here in the state of Oregon, city of Portland, becoming one of those seven finalists, along with San Francisco, Denver, Austin, Pittsburgh, Columbus, and Kansas City. Here's the place that I usually would spend a little bit more time in the presentation. I think it's of interest to a lot of people, but not really going to be your policy issues, and we'll get more quickly into the connected and autonomous part of this story. But we focused very heavily in our proposal in Portland, not so much on technology and widgets, but really on the people. And we really tried to address some equity issues and really tried to focus on neighborhoods within Portland that have historically been underinvested in transportation and figure out ways of really pushing the technology and solutions out into those neighborhoods and making sure that we're being as equitable with this investment as possible. So we have a mobility marketplace that we nicknamed UB Mobile PDX for ubiquitous mobility in Portland. And that has a financial clearinghouse marketplace element to it that could, and we actually identified opportunities for partnering with Origo and expanding our marketplace and seeing how ODOT can work together with our team. There's open data cloud portion to this, and then a user interface, which I'll just kind of dive into quickly. The ultimate goal is going to be the ability for our folks in Portland to be able to pull out an application and say, I want to start my trip in point A and I want to end my trip in point B, and list all of the different modes of getting there that outside of the single occupant vehicle, and give them options.
list off these options and combinations from a rideshare service to transit to bike share, you name it, allow them to see the cost and travel time and environmental impacts of that combination of trip mode choice. Allow them the ability to sort, if they're in a day where they just need to get to their destination as quickly as possible, they can sort those trips by the soonest trip. But if they have a little bit more flexibility in travel time, maybe sort those trips by cheapest or even greenest, and then be able to see, really understand the impacts. These are actual screenshots of an application that exists down in L.A. that Xerox built for L.A. and is rolled out in Denver. So the private sector is already developing applications that are far down this path. The next step in this world is to be able to pick one of those trips and say purchase, and with a single button press, it executes the sets up the Lyft ride, sets up your light rail ticket, and sets up the bike share on the other end of it. And when we can really remove those kinds of barriers for people, we think they're going to make some different mode choices. This kind of data also allows us to develop what we call gamification tools, where you can compete with your friends for who's been burning the most calories on their commute choices this month, or compete with yourself on, am I meeting either my environmental goals or my budget goals in my transportation choices. And again, with these kinds of tools, we can really help kind of guide mobility choices the way we want to see them from a policy standpoint in the region. But most of the money is going to go into investment in infrastructure. And so $70 million sounds like a big number at first, but you all deal with big numbers when you do big projects. And so we recognized we could not spread that all out over Portland and have a real significant impact. So we had to focus on corridors where we would invest in connected vehicle and autonomous vehicle testing functionality. And again, coming back to the equity story we were talking about, we very specifically selected the Powell Division corridor all the way from the river out to Gresham, and we selected the Columbia corridor, and we actually added a third corridor after the original proposal of North-South corridor out on 122nd in Portland. And the point with Powell Division in particular is it's a bit of a microcosm of all of the urban issues that we deal with in Portland. We're on the west side, close to the Columbia, the Willamette River. There's a section of Division that's very dense, heavy, new development, and very little parking. And so they're dealing with one set of problems there. But you go further out east, and you get east of I-205. And that's where we're dealing with a whole different set of problems, with roads that were never finished and massive potholes and very unsafe pedestrian conditions. I think you're about 2.5 times as likely to die as a pedestrian east of 205 than west of 205. There's very stark differences there. And so we're looking at making this investment in that corridor. Up on Columbia, we have some of the same issues with pedestrian. We have a different set of issues with a lot of jobs and good low, medium, and some higher paying jobs up there, but very poor transit and transportation services into that area. We also have a huge opportunity with freight, with the airport being on the east side of the corridor and our marine terminals being on the west side of the corridor, and then tying into I-5, we have an opportunity to really do some demonstrations of the types of technologies that Daimler is talking about in particular here. There's also going to be a heavy focus on sensors, and not just the traditional intelligent transportation sensors that we put in, but other sensors like air quality sensors and sound and lighting, and really being able to understand, if we make this kind of investment in transportation, what is that actually doing to air quality? What is that doing to sound? What is that doing to lighting in our neighborhoods? The Google Alphabet partnership with Sidewalk Labs also brought this investment of these community kiosks that they're currently building out in New York City. There's a project that started in New York City a few years ago where they said, we have all of these payphones around town that nobody is using anymore, but they're in very valuable real estate. They're right out here on the sidewalk. They have power and they have communications. There's got to be something more valuable for our citizens that we could do with that than a payphone that nobody's even maintaining anymore and is becoming an eyesore. And so through a partnership, they came up with this program and are currently rolling these out across New York City. And these are community kiosks that have a a touch screen where people can come up and get traveler information, like when's my bus going to be here, or city services information, or a whole number, virtually anything that's available on the internet. So the issue is more what are we going to limit, not what all are we going to put in there. There's phone applications. It's also a community Wi-Fi hotspot. And this Sidewalk Labs has committed to 100 of these kiosks to the winning city of Smart Cities Challenge. So we're really excited about the opportunity there. And as part of our whole equity message, we'd be making sure that these are going at least equally, if not overbalanced, into the neighborhoods that, again, are traditionally underserved.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
That just brought up again my level of thoughts on privacy was, you know, was going down because I thought you guys were saying, hey, we're paying attention to all that. But then you've got these 100 places where people go up, and you're telling me some technology company that is known to sell things when they find out information about stuff. So, again, when will you ask them that question, please, on privacy? If it's a public place, okay, that's fine, but you're putting in private information. We do that all the time for parking, you know, and we put in our bank card and all that. But it just seems to me that that's another place where privacy issues, who's in charge of that privacy? So, and who's going to be, you know, protecting the privacy of anybody who uses a kiosk?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative McClain, we certainly did ask the question, and they gave an even better answer on personal privacy than we normally hear from Google.
Good.
But what I would encourage is that if the City of Portland is successful, because this is going to be affecting the city and it is going to be affecting your constituents in the state, that you get them up here to convince you, as much as they convinced us on the technical side, that they are protecting your privacy.
Sounds like a legislative policy issue. Okay.
Could be. So on those corridors, and hopefully I'm getting through this fast enough, but we are focused on demonstrating the connected vehicle technology that was presented earlier in the morning by Jerry, as well as the automated vehicle functionality that we're talking about here on this panel. On the connected side, there are a number of applications. Jerry was showing a handful of them, from accident up ahead, there's an emergency vehicle coming down another block that you can't see, transit requesting transit signal priority, trucks requesting truck signal priority. It's a whole potential massive safety issue along that Columbia corridor. Trucks having to slam on their brakes to try to make a red light, or knowing that they're not going to be able to make a red light and having to blow through it, are a tremendous safety problem. And the ability for that truck to talk to the signal and request an extended green time and clear that intersection has tremendous safety benefits. So there's a number of connected vehicle applications that we'd be testing through this project if we are successful there. The Mobileye vendor that I was talking about before, their commitment into the Smart Cities Challenge was that they would outfit 300 buses of the winning city's fleet with this crash avoidance technology that has sensors that are sensing around the vehicle where there's a pedestrian or a bike and notifying the driver that there's somebody in that blind spot. So this actually goes even further than the connected vehicle application, where that bike or the pedestrian would have to be carrying an application. This actually senses anybody that's in that blind spot. And so then it would be up to TriMet to decide whether they say, we'll invest our own money and install the rest of the 300 fleet, or we decide with that $70 million that we're going to put some of the money to the rest of the fleet, or whether we want to do a pilot project first and then make decisions later. Building off of the sort of phased implementation discussion around autonomous vehicle testing, we've proposed a similar sort of phasing, but because this Smart Cities Challenge is a very rapid schedule on the US DOT's part, the phasing that we've talked about in here is a lot more rapid than what I think you would be thinking about and then what GN was talking about. We would be testing fully autonomous vehicles in controlled environments like OMSI, for example. It seems like a great place to run around their campus, expose the public to some new technology, kind of fits in with the whole vibe there, but we can do it in a low-speed and controlled environment.
We have Portland Community College and Mount Hood Community College on the same corridor, again, very controlled environments that we can be testing user acceptance of autonomous vehicles, testing and learning about safety issues, and if and when we're comfortable, start to potentially roll those out even into our neighborhoods as a supplement to transit, going around, again, low speed travel through the neighborhood, picking up passengers and bringing them to our major transit lines. Again, we've discussed in our proposal that we would be trying to go that way within the 3 years of their Smart City Challenge grant, but only doing it, again, balancing, you know, safety with speed and innovation. We have a local partner that's building electric vehicles that we could be offering this kind of service with humans driving it with very little automation on day one and sort of slowly build up the automation. And maybe it's only partially, maybe we're only comfortable with level three, level four automation. We don't go all the way into full automation. The GM Lyft partnership that was discussed earlier is another big partner in the city of Portland's proposal. We're really excited about this partnership. Not only are they heading towards the vehicle automation and Lyft as the rideshare provider and GM as the manufacturer in the longer run, they have very short-term projects and that they are going to be rolling out that offer sort of a triple win from our perspective. Very affordable lease and even rental programs of a Chevy Bolt if you're going to be a Lyft operator that we're excited to, through this partnership, really encourage this marketing, the deployment of this concept in our underserved neighborhoods in particular, because it would then give us this triple win of pushing electric vehicles out into our neighborhoods that are often not even thought about as migrating to electric vehicles. It'll offer job opportunities for folks that want to get into any job but would be really happy to get a Lyft driver job, but their car doesn't qualify or they don't even own a car. So there's some really exciting opportunities there. The freight corridor, I talked about Columbia Boulevard, and again, partnering with, we're partnering, City of Portland's partnering with Daimler on looking at some testing of connected vehicle and maybe even partial autonomous functionality along this corridor as well. And Daimler's response was, we've been wanting to do vehicle-to-infrastructure communications for a long time. Nobody was investing in the infrastructure. So you do that part, we'll do the vehicle part, and we'd love to test some of these same sorts of applications. So the timeline of Smart City Challenge, it was only announced back in November, and proposals were due right at the beginning of the year. And then in March, they shortlisted it down to those seven cities that we talked about earlier. And they don't call it a request for proposal. They call it a notice of funding opportunity. But that NOFO deadline was actually yesterday. And we got our final proposal submitted into the USDOT. We got acceptance that it was received incomplete on time by the USDOT. Our next big milestone is to go out to Washington, D.C. and present our proposal directly to the secretary. And it's a very interesting, keeping with the innovative selection process that I was talking about before, USDOT is going to have staff reviewing those proposals but not scoring them. And they're going to look at each of those different vision elements that I showed on the earlier slide and say, are they meeting it? Is it acceptable? Is it a fail? Is it exceptional? Here's some general comments, and give all of that feedback to the secretary, and then the secretary is picking the winning city. And so we'll hopefully find out by the end of June or early July. But you can see that we're actually talking about a lot of things on the connected side and on the autonomous side that are kind of getting out ahead of where we even are from a policy standpoint. So if we're successful, I think we're going to have some pretty quick conversations about what that means here.
Okay.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I learned a valuable lesson in the self-serve gas discussions. This actually started many years ago, and we actually got the bill passed just a few months ago. But the issue is jobs and the concerns that many people have that this disruptive technology is going to end up with everybody standing along the street with no jobs. And so I understand the value of bringing those kinds of issues to the table quickly. Yep. And but on the other hand, I also remember the situation with cabooses on trains took long time to get rid of them, and people were simply not, they just weren't necessary any longer. So my vision on these trucks is people sleeping in the front of the truck as it drives them all over the place, but they're still there. So I don't want to understate the importance of this issue, because it's everywhere, all these jobs being replaced with code. So how are you bringing that into this discussion?
I think it's a discussion that we're going to need to have at a state level and at the city level. As far as this particular pursuit, we had to kind of just say there's a lot of issues. There's the insurance issues that you brought up before. There's all kinds of liability issues that are still at play, that and there's the long-term impacts of jobs. There's long-term impacts of lost revenue sources between, you know, ticketing, and there's a lot of impacts that are going to come. And so we had to say we can't address all those issues now. We have to just put the blinders on and get this proposal in. So that's with regards to this Smart Cities challenge. I think it needs to, that conversation needs to begin, because the job issue is a massive one. And but as far as the Smart Cities challenge, we weren't able to even try to address it.
Mr. Chair, I just want to suggest a work group on this, and I want to make sure that we lawyers that are going to be robbed of the jobs from the auto accidents are taken into account. Just saying. I'm in all seriousness. We in our discussions about income inequality and the hollowing out of the middle class by virtue of mechanization, this issue has come up over and over and over. And so I understand how it would seem to be a consequence of something that's going to happen no matter what we do, but it deserves attention, and I'm just not quite sure where or how, because it's really difficult.
If I may, Representative Benz, when it came to manual transmissions on Class 8 trucks, your manual 13-speed, 15, 18, to now automated manuals, there's been a significant improvement in addressing driver shortage. So technology does open up what used to be considered as a hardcore, male-dominated a profession to someone who can drive an automated manual. It's practically automatic for most people. So it does open up. Technology does open up more people to become a part of this specific pool. Now, if you equate that to the autonomous driving, where you have stage 2, stage 3 autonomous driving, now you can expect people who don't have hours and hours of driving experience also be considered for these jobs potentially, because the vehicle is able to protect them for 99.9% of the time. The 0.1% of the time when it is snowing down a certain road and the system cannot see or the sensor is broken, yes, that is when you have these drivers come in. So when it comes to jobs, I think these technologies are helping open up the pool of people who can apply for being a driver, for example.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I would disagree with that, but that's because all the reading I've done suggests that as we automate, we lose jobs and they're not being replaced. And it has to do with the speed at which the change is occurring. Because getting people retrained takes time. This is happening really fast. And so we've been robbed of that opportunity to train people up by virtue of the slow nature of transition. So that's what I've read about it. I'm going to mention the situation with the longshoremen in Portland. And much of that slowdown is driven by the fact that automation is taking those jobs. And who can blame them for trying to figure out some way of keeping them? I mean, those are good jobs. But this is not something that we can just say is bad. We have to figure out a solution. So I raise the issue so that we're all aware of it.
Tim McLean?
On that same theme of, you know, transition and the speed of transition and dealing with real issues that have impacts, because we don't want to have winners and losers. We want the economy to be, you know, continuing to grow in a way that all people can participate in it. And for me, that's another issue, is the fact that, as you all point out, technology is going so quickly and everybody's so excited about everything they can do and everything that's possible and the potential and the pluses, you know, to the technology. But whenever there's a plus, there's always sort of a balance, and we have to look, okay, it's a plus this way, you know, where are we dealing with a negative transition timing, or with the jobs, or with just market acceptance? Because you guys maybe, you know, and I say that with all support that this has been an exciting, you know, exciting information. And the smart city, wow, that sounds like a real big opportunity. But again, we're having to deal with the transition and market acceptability. And, you know, we have to deal with the fact that you're also, you know, changing even new players in the market. Now, Uber, I can see how they can fit into this. Lyft and, you know, some of these other folks, I can see how they can fit into this. But again, it's changing so quickly. And you're going from the idea that these are, you know, owned cars to, you know, you're bringing somebody else into the mix. So there's three people to split the pie instead of two. And again, you're talking about salaries, and you're talking about opportunity, and you're talking about transition in different ways for different parts of the system. So I just don't want us to, you know, to act like this is all positive, you know, fabulous. There are realities to deal with, and especially market transition, I think you folks are all very aware of. So we just have to figure out how to deal with that. So a work group sounds good, but I think it sounds like this work group better start today, because it sounds like you guys are, you're on the road, or you're on the way to really bringing some reality to this technology.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean, if I may, I know I shouldn't be bringing up even more issues that you're going to be wrestling with, but this was brought to my attention by ODOT. It was I gave a very similar Smart Cities presentation to an ad hoc sort of informal group that had sort of self-formed within ODOT that deals with transportation issues and technology issues, and gave the Smart Cities presentation, and the response that has resonated with me ever since was, that's very exciting. That's a neat set of issues that Portland is going to be dealing with, but that's PBOT and Metro that are going to have to be setting up the policy and a lot of the regulatory issues within that. We're worried about the rest of Oregon, and how do we make sure that that all this exciting stuff you're talking about with Uber and Lyft and electric vehicles and smart cities doesn't just create the next major digital divide issue that we had with telecommunications for all of these years, and transportation become the next big digital divide? What about Bend? What about Ontario? What about Joseph? And I thought that was a really important point. I've been trying to make sure that we're partnering with ODOT as well within this Smart Cities proposal, and we're going to be learning as much as we can from these different partnerships and how to help guide that kind of investment into those other communities. But it's yet another issue that the state's going to need to deal with. So the working group should start tomorrow.
Yeah, today. Okay.
Any questions?
No.
Well, thank you very much for your time. That brings us to the end of our agenda for the day.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much, and have a wonderful Wednesday. May's adjourned.
So, interesting, we brought up the idea of...